First of all, I'd like to thank Carlo for this invitation, opportunity to study a little bit together. The question that was suggested that we speak about is the very difficult subject of how one's free will interacts with other people. Okay, the difficulty is this. How does my free will interact with your, let's call it, hashgach? In other words, how can I affect you in a way that you apparently do not deserve? Right? This is one of the most difficult subjects in what we call machshava or hashgacha, whatever you want to call it. It's a very difficult philosophical problem. And even people who have a lot of Jewish background, learning, find this a difficult and often distressing subject. So let's think it through together. Again, first of all, let's just clarify the problem. The problem is, how do I have free will to interact with you and do something to you that's not in line with your own... See, English words are confused here. Destiny is an inaccurate word. But how do I harm you if you do not have that harm coming? If you don't deserve it or need it, if it's not part of your hashgacha. Right? If you want to make this clear, imagine someone walking down the street who has no need, let's say, to die. That means if you could interview Hashem, you could speak to God, and you could ask him, what is this person's status in your eyes? And Hashem would say, there's no reason that this person is going to die today. That means he does not have a decree of death upon him. That's the correct technical term, what we call a gzera. There's no gzera in Shemayim. That means it's not being decreed that he will die today. And at that moment, someone turns the corner and tries to kill him. Right? Did you see the problem? Yes? Anyone? No? Anyone out there? That's a problem, right? How does somebody impinge their free will on someone else in a way that the victim does not deserve, either to help them or to harm them? Is the problem clear? Okay, to set the stage, let's take a few steps back. Let me describe to you an amazing scenario, and then we will use that as a framework on which to build the subject. There was an incident that occurred, this must be, I guess, 200 years ago, which went as follows. And this, if you'd like to look it up, you'll find it in the Pisrei Tshuva, in Yerodea, and Yud Ches. He records his response to this question. But let me fill you in on the background, give you a broader picture of what in fact happened. There was a commercial fair, you know, like an expo, if I'm not mistaken, it was in Leipzig, where people came to display their wares, people would buy and sell. And in that environment, what used to happen was, if there was a dispute, a financial dispute, they used to constitute a Beis Din. Even the non-Jews there would subject themselves to the same arbitration. They would constitute a Beis Din, a Jewish court of three judges, who would hear the dispute and adjudicate the dispute. On one occasion, there was present at this particular commercial exposition a very highly qualified Talmudic sage, one of the great rabbinic figures of that generation. It's not clear to us exactly who it was, but we have his question. But he records the fact that he was present at this fair. And what turned out was this. Two Jews turned out to have some financial dispute, and a Beis Din was duly constituted in order to hear the case. And it turned out that the Beis Din comprised two people who were elected, and the third was he himself, this very accomplished Talmudic figure, somebody of major Torah knowledge. And it records the following dilemma. The three judges sat and began to hear the case, and he says it became immediately apparent to him that the other two judges were colluding dishonestly against the innocent party. Okay, in other words, they were dishonest, and it was very clear to him that no matter what he said and no matter what happened, they would vote dishonestly against the innocent party, and not only that, he would become a party to a miscarriage of justice. You know that in Halakha, a judgment of a Beis Din is given as if unanimous. You know that? You know that in American law, I'm sure you can correct me, you have, when even the Supreme Court sits, you have a dissenting opinion, right? If one of the justices wishes to dissent, he can record a dissenting opinion. In Halakha, that's forbidden. When a Beis Din issues a ruling, then it comes down as if a unanimous fiat of the Beis Din. Right? If you're on trial, and I'm part of the Beis Din, and I hold like you for you, and the others outvote me, I may not come to you afterwards and say, look, I was on your side, but they outvoted me. I'm not allowed to disclose that. In other words, the ruling comes down as if it was a unanimous decision of all of them. The Beis Din becomes one unit, and the decision is the decision of a unit. So he would have been carried along in a miscarriage of justice, and there was nothing he could do. What could he do? He could vote for the truth, but the two who were lying would outvote him. Well, what could he do? Dissent. Dissent. That wouldn't help, because that. So he could what you call, in English you call it, recuse himself from the case. In halacha, that is constituted by saying "Eineni yodea," I don't know. If a judge in Beis Din says "I don't know," then he is distanced from the case, and of course you have now only two judges left. And in halacha, you can never have an even number of. Why in American law a jury consists of 12 people, I have no idea. I mean, that's a recipe for trouble, right? We don't have that. In halacha, there's always an odd number of dayanim, and since there will be only two left, the case is closed. Or they add two more, or they start. But at least that case is immediately closed. So he sat there and he said to himself, well, I could say I don't know, and that would solve the problem of my having to vote in a dishonest Beis Din. But the problem with that would be, to say I don't know, you would have had to lie. Because he didn't know. So he said the dilemma that faced him was this. Do I vote for the truth and have a falsehood result? Or do I say a falsehood to have the truth result? Isn't that an amazing question? What is the Torah concept of truth here? Is the concept of truth to say the truth? The result will be distorted, but that's not my problem. Or does the Torah require me to distort what I think in order to achieve truth as a result? You know, this is a sophisticated question, because halakhically we have a concept that truth is not necessarily the naked meaning of the words, right? Truth in halakha is always contextual. Example, you're sitting at home and the phone rings. Your wife picks it up. From her tone of voice and expression on her face, you realize this is someone you don't want to speak to. So this is what you do. You step out the door and you say, "Not." And your wife says, "I'm sorry, it's not in." Is that truth or is that a lie? So on the one hand, you were not in, right? You were on the other side of the door. What would you say? It's a lie. So the halakhic authorities who've dealt with this type of situation have ruled that that's a deeper lie than remaining in the room and saying you're not available. Because the question is not asking on which side of the doorstep are you standing. The question is asking if you're available, if you're there. So you can't get out of a falsehood situation by a technicality. So to say, what is the truth here? Is it to vote correctly and speak the truth even though a distortion will result? Or is it to say, in fact, a distortion to ensure that truth results? What would you say?
I had a question to go back on what you said about being in the house. What happens if you exit the house, the rear, and stay outside and not in the house?
What's the difference where you exit?
Not in the house.
But you were not in the house. You were outside the door when you said I was not home.
You mean outside of the house?
Sure.
Oh, then you meant?
Of course, that's the front door, can't you see? So hold on a sec. He said this. He stood there thinking about it. He sat there and he came up with what he thought might be a precedent. Okay, now stay with me.
Yeah, I understand. Why doesn't he just extricate himself by calling the whole Beis Din null and void and take them to test and say that the Beis Din is possible?
Because they disagree. And who's to say, who externally will know that they are lying?
But if he knows that they're lying...
So that he can recuse himself and say, "You're liars, I'm getting out of here."
That's right. Why
isn't Yaakov doing it? This is. Okay. Hold the questions for a moment. Right now I'm having enough trouble with me. He came up with what he thought might be a precedent. And here's the precedent. The Talmud discusses a case that the Rambam deals with of the Sanhedrin that has to vote. Now, you know, when the Sanhedrin voted, let's say on a capital matter, right? You need a Sanhedrin of 23 or 71. You need a large group of the sages. We don't have that today. But when the Sanhedrin votes on a capital matter, then what happens is, first of all, you know, they sat in a semicircle, right? So that they could all see each other. And you know that the vote went from junior to senior. the most junior would vote first, and then they would end with a senior vote, right? What is the reason for that? They didn't want a junior to be influenced by a prior senior vote. Now let's say you have a capital matter, right? Let's say, for example, this person is on trial for his life, and you are the incredibly highly qualified members of the Great Sanhedrin. I'm sure you're all duly qualified, and you're about to hear this capital case. Imagine that you mind being the junior on the Sanhedrin? You have to be a major black belt, you know, to be on the Sanhedrin. Okay, you're going to vote first, and we're going to go around the Sanhedrin. Everyone's going to vote, okay, after all the evidence has been heard, until we come to the senior major black belt halakhic authority of the generation, the Mufla Shiva Sanhedrin, who will cast the final vote. Now, if it's a capital matter, there's a peculiarity in the voting which you do not have in a secular system. And that is that you need, of course, a majority, right? Afrei Rabin Lahatois, the Torah says, you need a majority to convict or to acquit. And therefore, if there's a majority, let's say, to convict the person, in suitable circumstances, he will have a death sentence only. But there's one unique proportion of majority to convict that acquits. Right? In other words, you have the Sanhedrin. If more than half of them vote to execute the accused, then he will receive a death sentence. But if there's a particular proportion of majority to convict him, that paradoxically will acquit him. What's that proportion? If there's a unanimous, you don't need me to say it at all, right? If there's a unanimous vote to convict, he's acquitted. That means if they all say guilty, he's free. What's the reason? One possibility is that if
all white, you're
that's a very nice idea. Well, one suggestion is that if they all vote for guilty, we are concerned that if nobody at least argued for his innocence, perhaps they didn't examine the case well enough. Right? That means, first of all Jews agreeing. I mean, you know, there's got to be something wrong with that, right? That's cool. But if nobody could argue in his favor, we are suspicious, right, that they didn't examine the case well enough, and that's not good enough. There was a movie made, probably the last kosher movie ever made, in 1950, called 12 Angry Men. You ever see that? This, I don't care how from you are, this movie is acceptable. If you don't want to watch a movie, you can read the screenplay. It was a play, and it is a courtroom drama where 11 people start off accusing holding guilty in a murder case, and one doesn't, and it's a fascinating examination of this issue. But be that as it may, if they all vote to convict, then the person is acquitted. Now, so far so good? Okay, now imagine this is the scenario. This person's on trial for his life. All the evidence has been heard, and the voting begins. And the voting goes like this. We start here, right? Guilty, 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 death, death, execute, guilty, etc., etc., etc. They all say guilty until we arrive here. There's one vote left, and this great halakhic leader of the generation knows that the man's guilty. Do you see his dilemma? Because if he speaks his mind and says guilty, this murderer walks free. So what should he do, asks the Rambam? Should he say guilty, which is how he reads the case, and have a guilty man freed? Or should he distort what he thinks and say innocent to have him convicted, which is the truth?
Guilty.
Well, you have to be a major halakhic authority to answer that fast. But you happen to be correct. The Rambam says that he should say what he believes. The fact that this person is free is not our problem, that's his. Yeah, as it were. Okay. Now, is this in fact the correct precedent for our case of the three judges? He thought perhaps this is an example he can use. And if the Rambam tells us that in a case like this, the final authority in the Beis Din, in the Sanhedrin, must in fact say the truth, we can reason that in the three judge scenario, when the other two are lying, he also should say the truth, and the result is not his problem. I'd like to suggest to you that in fact is not a valid precedent, but I'm not going to tell you why. I'd like you to have some sleepless nights figuring it out. If there's time, we'll come back to it at the end of our discussion and try to resolve that issue. But he sent that question to the great Pesachei Teshuvah, and you can look up his answer there. If there's time, we'll go into it. He has a fascinating analysis of this case, and he shows effectively why these two cases are not exactly parallel, and he comes to a very clear resolution.
Yudches.
Cheshen Mishpat. Cheshen Mishpat Yudches. Excuse me. There's a lengthy Pisgachuva there, and he doesn't bring the historical background, but he gives a ruling on this case. You'll find it fascinating. If there's time, we'll come back to that. Let's go back to our subject and see how we can illuminate this problem, right, from with this beginning. Our problem is, how does one person's free will affect another? A is walking down the street, and he has, let's say, a clean sheet in terms of no gzeira against him. B tries to kill him. We have here a major clash of Torah principles. On the one hand, we have the notion of free will, which is what the world was created for, that I have the freedom of will to act morally or immorally. And on the other hand, we have what's called Ashgacha, that means the individual walking down the street, the victim, as it were, is a person who may not deserve to be killed. We have here a tremendous clash. It would seem that whichever way you approach this situation, you're in trouble. If you say that A can no way kill B because B doesn't deserve to die, so then you are fine in terms of the recipient or the victim. He's not going to die if he doesn't deserve it. Hashem's Hashgacha is going to take care of him. But you have very severely limited the free will of A. That means that A is not free to kill him. On the other hand, if you say that A is free to kill him, that's fine in terms of the proactive nature of the free will of A, but it's very problematic, extremely distressing, in terms of B dying when he doesn't deserve to. What happened to the divine protection, as it were, that should be afforded him if he doesn't deserve to die? This seems to be a very bitter and distressing dilemma, and in fact it is. What are the approaches, what's the Torah approach to this situation? And you know, whichever way you go, if you say that my free will never affects you, in other words, if A kills B, the correct reading of the situation must be that B had to die then anyway. That's the only way to read it. If you say that I can never use my free will to do something to you that you don't deserve, so if you see A kill B, the correct interpretation must be B was going to die then anyway. A only chose to be the agent, but he never affected the outcome. If you take that line of thinking, it means that you never affect anyone else. You can never do anything to anyone else. The correct interpretation of your interaction with anyone else will always be they had it coming. You couldn't help anyone either. Let's say you gave tzedakah, charity, to a person who badly needed it, right? So you walked in and you gave them money and you saved their situation completely. Correct interpretation, they had it coming. Had it not been you, it could have been someone else. You chose to be the agent. No doubt you get the mitzvah. Okay, it's credited to you. But the result is not credited to you. No? That seems to be a very counterintuitive way to look at our free will in the world. On the other hand, if you say that you are the real, genuine agent of the person's the consequence, so then that would seem that you can help someone who does not deserve to be helped. And that's even more distressing, you can harm someone who doesn't deserve to be harmed. Are we clear about the problem? What is the approach to this situation? There are two approaches to this in classical Jewish thinking. This is probably an argument that goes all the way back to the Zohar. And since that time on, there have been two classic approaches to this situation. Let me try to spell them out, and then show that although they seem to be extremely divergent, in fact, they are not that far apart. The first approach is that, in fact, you never affect anyone else. The correct interpretation of any human interaction is that my free will, I'm free to act, but the consequence has nothing to do with me. This opinion you find in many classic sources, perhaps the most famous is Rav Sadia Gaon, in his great work, Emunas Vadeus. He says there very clearly, and many other sources follow this, he says very clearly that when one person harms someone else, the correct interpretation of that interaction is that the victim had it coming. The assailant, the aggressor, the one who acts, takes full responsibility. They are judged 100% accordingly. But the effect was not up to them. The correct interpretation is that the victim would have died exactly at that moment in an exactly parallel or analogous fashion. To be sure, the assailant, the aggressor, the murderer is held fully accountable, but is only held accountable for pulling the trigger and making the choice. The fact that the bullet found its mark and that the victim died has got nothing to do with him. You know what this means, of course. You're pulling out of here this afternoon in your great four-wheel drive monster that you all need to get to downtown Chicago. And as you back out, somebody carelessly, without looking, rams straight into your vehicle, makes a big dent, damages your car seriously. You get out and you start yelling, and well, you Chicagoans, you'd get out and say, good afternoon. I'm sure you're all Bale Musa, you wouldn't get angry. And then you say to the guy, look what you've done to my car. And the other guy says, but you're an observant Jew, aren't you? And you say, yes. He says, you must have had it coming. Well, according to a Sajjah, you must have had it coming. You can take him to Beis Din and extract the costs for the damage only because the Torah says so. But you have to know that you had this damage coming. That does not seem to be the way that we relate to the world intuitively. When someone gets hurt by someone else, right, it's very neat to say that the damage was accruing anyway, but it does not look to us as if that's the case. It certainly looks to us as if A certainly perpetrated the damage. Nevertheless, Rav Sajjah says the correct interpretation of those situations is that the victim must have deserved what happened, and the person doing the action was simply playing into the hands of his, let's call it, destiny. He puts it exquisitely beautifully, as only the Rishonim can. For the Rishonim, he puts it like this. He says, and I would challenge you to attempt to say this more succinctly than he does. In just one very brief sentence, he says the whole principle. He says, when A kills B, and B dies, all that happened was that the way he puts it is, a misser becomes a retzach. Isn't that beautiful? A death becomes a murder, that's all. Isn't that exquisite? If A had not killed B, B would have died. Now that A killed B, B got murdered. But he would have died in that fashion, an analogous fashion, with all the ripple effects on his family and all the other consequences. All those would have happened anyway. Only the person who acted chose to be the agent, and what he's held accountable for is for being the agent. That is the opinion of Rav Sajjah Gaon, and that is one classic approach to this situation. But there's another approach, and the other approach is also found in classic sources, and that is that when a person affects someone else, they are not simply playing into the hands of the destiny of the person who receives the consequence, but they are in fact forming that consequence themselves, right? And what's, if you like, easy to understand, or perhaps more natural to understand here, is that the one who's acting has the power to act. What's difficult to understand is, how does the victim become a victim of something that he does not deserve? Yeah, that needs further thought, and perhaps even on a Kabbalistic level that needs to be understood. But that is the opinion of many great Torah authorities. Let me speak out the most classic source without question for this particular opinion, and then let's think out some of the consequences. The most classic source without question is the famous Orach Chaim. The Orach Chaim discusses Joseph being sold by his brothers. When Yosef was sold by his brothers, the Orach Chaim has a classic insight there, and the Malbim says the same thing, and the Alshik says the same, and many others follow this line of thinking. And he says as follows. You know, when Joseph was sold by his brothers, there was a discussion among the brothers. Let me briefly paraphrase, according to the Orach Chaim, what in fact transpired. They saw their brother approaching. They held that he was a lethal danger to them, without going into the background why they thought that. And they thought that this brother needed to be killed. And they judged him, and they were going to execute him in terms of their judgment. Background on the many, many difficult issues and problems. How could brothers form a Beis Din on a brother? All sorts of questions here, but nevertheless, they ruled that he was a roideh, an aggressor on them, and in fact on all of Jewish history, and therefore they needed to kill him. And this is what they said. As they saw him approach in the distance, they said, behold, this dreamer of dreams approaches. Let us kill him. And the language is Venire, and let's see Mayu Michalomoisa. Let's kill him, and let's see what happens to his dreams, what becomes of his dreams. The childish interpretation of those words is sarcastic statement. You know, we'll kill him and see what becomes. Don't forget, Joseph dreamed that they would ultimately come to bow down to him, and they felt that those dreams were malicious and completely unfounded and false, and therefore they said, let's kill him and see what becomes of his dreams. Says Orach Chaim, what they really meant was this. He dreamed that we would bow down to him in the future. We hold that those dreams are false. We feel that he needs to be killed. If we kill him, not only will justice have been done, but justice will immediately be seen to have been done. Why? Because the moment he dies, it becomes obvious that the dreams are false. Yeah? Again, here's Joseph's lifetime, right? Here's his lifetime. Imagine here, when he's 17 years old, he tells his brothers that at the future,
they will bow down to him. If we kill him now, the future is known. We'll never bow down to him then. So we will know now that the dreams were false. So not only will we be able to do justice now, we'll be able to immediately demonstrate that we were right. Let's see what becomes of his dreams. If he dies, we know now that the dreams were false, because the dreams spoke about a future event that can now never happen. So we will be not only have done justice, but we'll be immediately vindicated as well. So Reuben spoke up and he said, you're making a tragic error. You're making a fundamental philosophical error. It's possible that his dreams here about the future are correct, and that you will come to bow down to him and his dreams are right. But human free will is so important, Hashem created the world for that, that he will allow you to use your free will to kill him now, despite the fact that there was a destiny meant to happen, and your free will distort that destiny and falsify it, and you will assume that the dreams were incorrect and you'll be wrong. You were meant to bow down to him in the future. He was right. But Hashem rearranged the whole cosmic computer program on the spot when you used your free will, because human free will is so important that Hashem would rearrange the whole creation for that, to give that its power, and therefore you'll be able to kill him, and you'll be able to kill him wrongly. So the brothers said to Reuben, what should we do? So he said, look, instead of killing him, let's throw him into this pit in the desert. Now there was a pit, right, present, and the Torah says famously, Gemara talks about it in two places, it says, V'haboy reik ein boy mayim. The pit was empty, it contained no water. Well, the obvious problem is, and the Gemara speaks this out, if it was empty, then obviously it contained no water. Answers the Gemara, it contained no water, but it contained lethally dangerous snakes and scorpions. Maral says it wasn't full of snakes and scorpions. It wasn't full of snakes and scorpions, because if it were, and they threw him in, death would be guaranteed, right? In halacha, if you cause someone's death by indirect means, but inevitable indirect means, you can't say you're not responsible. If you hold someone's head under the water, you say, well, I didn't kill him, it just was a lack of oxygen. You can't get away from that, right? You know? So if they threw him into a pit that was full of snakes and scorpions, as he landed on them, they bit him and stung him, they would certainly be accountable. Says the Maral, but there were enough snakes and scorpions in there that there was a lethal danger, and therefore he said, look, let's not kill him, let's throw him into the pit. Well, the obvious question is, you know, you're not going to kill him, you're going to throw him into a pit of snakes and scorpions? That's not killing him? Answers the Or HaChaim, no. Because the difference between a human agent, that means killing a person with your own hand, or throwing him into a pit of snakes and scorpions, the difference is that no self-respecting scorpion is going to touch anybody who does not have a decree of death on him, because that is not an agent of free will. When a snake or a scorpion attacks someone, it does so only in terms of the person's hashgacha, let's call it destiny for want of a better word. Does he deserve to die? If he does, the scorpion will sting him. If it does not, it will not touch him. But you could kill somebody with your own hand who does not deserve to die, because you're an agent of free will, and that is so important that you could kill him even if it's inappropriate. And therefore, said Reuben, do not touch him with your hand. Put him into a pit of snakes and scorpions, where he will only get what is coming to him genuinely. In fact, it's very beautiful to see the words. I urge you to look it up. The language there is, it says, Vayatzilehu miyadam. And Reuben saved him from their hand. By throwing him into the pit of snakes and scorpions, Reuben didn't save his life. He saved him from their hand, says the Or HaChaim, miyad habechiri, from the hand of human free will. That was his concern. He wasn't concerned to save his life on this level. He was concerned to save him from the illegitimate action of a human hand that in fact might kill him inappropriately, and therefore he said, throw him into the pit. And of course what happened, as we all know, he did not die in the pit, because in fact he was not guilty at that level, and therefore the snakes and scorpions did not touch him. That is a classic derivation, and many other Torah commentaries follow this through, and despite all the questions that arise here, that is without doubt the classic source for one person being able to affect another despite the victim's inappropriate status of the victim. There are many other proofs. Let me share with you one very beautiful and elegant proof. This I heard personally from Rav Yaakov Weinberg in Baltimore, but again you'll find many others. He put it like this. Here's a very succinct proof. You know, when we say Tachanun, we quote the following words. We say Vayomer David El Gad. David said to God, Nipla na b'yad Hashem. Let us fall into Hashem's hand, Ki Rabim Rachamav, because Hashem is great in mercy. Uviyat Adam al Epola.
let me not fall into human hand. Ooh, those words are very telling. King David, David HaMelech, is standing facing two options. His life is in danger. He can either try to break out of his danger by going through the wilderness, where there are natural dangers, wild, hungry mountain lions and other natural dangers, or he can try to break through enemy lines. Well, if you take the first opinion that we studied today, what difference does it make? Every bullet has a name on, right? That means you're going to get it if you deserve it. Doesn't matter what the agency is. According to the first opinion of Sajagon, right? If you try to break out through the wild animals, if your life is forfeit at that moment, then it will be forfeit. If you try to break out through the enemy soldiers, then it will be forfeit that way. Doesn't make any difference. What difference does it make? Harbei Shluchim Lamokim. Hashem has many agencies. What difference does it make? Which agent you put yourself into to give you the destiny that is due? You see, David HaMelech does not think that way. He says, I have two options. I can face the hungry mountain lions, or I can face the Philistine soldiers. Let me not fall into human hands. Let me deal with Hashem directly. When you deal with hungry mountain lions, you're dealing with Hashem directly, because they are not agents of free will. You will only get killed by one of those, right, if you deserve it. But a Philistine soldier, a person, an agent of human free will, there's no telling what he might do. And therefore, is this clear? It's a very elegant and simple proof, it would seem, for the second opinion. Do not deal with human beings. They can harm you much worse than you deserve, in case you haven't noticed. But there's no, put it this way, no self-respecting hungry mountain lion is going to touch you unless you deserve to be eaten, and therefore King David makes that choice. It seems to be a very elegant proof for the second opinion. Of course, those of you who have some background in learning, what I hope you will do is, when we get through this discussion, you will start thinking through how are each of these proofs handled by the other side. Right? All these elegant proofs, each for its own opinion, they're all Torah sugyas, right? How does the Orach Chaim handle the other side? How does the Sadja handle, how would he read Joseph and his brothers? How would he read David speaking to God? Okay, that's homework and a fascinating exercise. So the second opinion, let's call it, is that you could affect someone in a way that does not deserve, that the person doesn't deserve to be affected. Now these sound like two extremely discrepant views. On the one hand, one opinion is you never get anything that's not coming to you, and according to the other, you could get a disastrous consequence that you don't deserve at all, because people have free will. Are they in fact that far apart? The truth is that the second opinion, let's call it the second one, that a person can affect someone else through their free will, has many modifying variables. And by the time we get through discussing some of these, I hope you'll see that the extent of a person's free will to affect someone else is much more limited than it would appear at first glance. Let me speak out some of those limiting variables. By far the most important is the fact that when I use my free will to harm someone else, I'm able to harm him using my free will only to the extent that he lacks schus. In other words, when somebody uses their free will to impinge on someone else, they can only impinge on them, they can only harm them, to the extent that the person is spiritually vulnerable. In other words, if you have spiritual merit, what we call schus, you will be protected against free will in proportion to the degree of merit. Is this clear? In other words, when we say that a person can affect someone else using his free will, we mean only to the extent that the recipient is not protected by enough schus, enough merit to protect him. Or put it like this, you need more schus to protect yourself against a human than against a non-human. You need less schus to be protected against a vicious dog or a hungry mountain lion than you do against a human aggressor with human intention. Not that you are completely vulnerable, but you are more vulnerable to people than you are to non-humans. Or put it another way, people are dangerous. People are more dangerous than non-human agents because they have that added... What kind of schus? Well, to make it clear, I would say this. If a person is spiritually impervious, that means they're absolutely invulnerable. What we call in the Torah terminology, a tzaddik gomor. A tzaddik gomor means somebody who has so much merit that there's no way that he could be affected, right? For example, the classic example in Jewish history is Mordechai. Mordechai knew that he was impervious to Haman's aggression, without going into the background and how he knew that, but he knew that he had enough protection, and therefore he could stand up to him in a full frontal
attack or defense, right? In other words, he decided to sit where Haman would walk past and drive him into such a frenzy of anti-Semitic hatred that he would self-destruct. That is a very dangerous game. A very dangerous game. The principle that governs Jewish history is Eretz Nitna Beyad Rosha. The world is given into the hands of the evil, in case you haven't noticed. Yeah? The world is not being run by spiritually accomplished, gentle, you know, people interested in your welfare. I'm sorry to have to disillusion you. But the world is being run by power-hungry, murderous and brutal individuals, right, who want your vote so that they can do whatever they want, unfortunately. Yeah? That's the democratic system. So, Eretz Nitna Beyad Rosha, the world is run by evil forces. That's the principle in post-biblical times, during the Talmudic era, in the era of Torah Shebaal Peh. The world is run by the evil agencies, and therefore we do not come face to face in full frontal attack. We are using strategy to walk between the raindrops and use wisdom rather than open conflict. However, Mordechai knew that despite the fact that the evil forces have the upper hand, he could come into direct conflict with Haman because he was spiritually inviolable, and that is a very dangerous game, but he knew that he had enough merit. In other words, if Yosef would have had enough source, the brothers would not have been able to kill him. If he was impervious, he had never done anything wrong, then all their human aggression would fail against him. The concern was that perhaps he didn't deserve to die, but perhaps he'd done something that lessened his chus. Perhaps the way he spoke about his brothers had lessened his spiritual protection, and therefore he'd be vulnerable to their killing him, even though he didn't deserve that consequence. In other words, the concept is, do you have enough merit to protect you, or do you not? How much chus you need is a question. Of course, it might not be your own merit that you need to protect you against aggression might not be your own, right? For example, Mr. A walking down the street might not have enough merit of his own, but it could be that his mother doesn't deserve that he should die. It could be that his wife doesn't deserve it. In other words, we're talking about here skus that fans out into all its ripples, right? And there are many consequences of this for those of you who like to feel that there is a practical output to this discussion, because in legal terms, there's no practical difference between the two opinions. If A hurts B, he's liable for it in din, whether you take the first or the second opinion, no question. The only difference is philosophical. According to the first opinion, B would have got the consequence anyway. A is liable technically. According to the second opinion, B is liable, not technically, because he really caused the damage, but in both cases, he's liable. But there are practical differences, and here's one of them. This is the reason why, opinion number two, some people do not take out insurance. Now, it's okay to take out insurance. Major Torah authorities say it's a very good idea to have insurance, life insurance, etc. Not against that. It's an excellent thing to do. But the logic for not taking out insurance is very clear. Mr. A is walking down the street, right? Mr. A has no life insurance policy. Mr. A has no gzera of death on him. No reason why he should die today. Mr. B turns the corner and tries to kill him. Well, Hashem looks down at Mr. A and says, no life insurance. What happens if he dies? His wife's in big trouble. Because Mr. A brings home the bacon. Well, whatever he brings home every day. And his wife depends on him. And therefore, if he has no life insurance, it could be that he does not deserve to be protected against this aggression, but perhaps his wife doesn't deserve it. And then Hashem might protect him, even though his merit is not good enough, because there's some ripple effect in his environment that is, in fact, deserving, right? Whereas if Mr. A is walking down the street with a $100 million life insurance policy, and Mr. B tries to kill him, Hashem could look down at Mr. A and say, your wife's okay. And in some cases, she's probably better off. Anyway, the point is that, be that as it may, this is a very strange way of thinking about one's merit, right? If you want to use a practical application of this beyond life insurance, this is a very good rationale for making yourself as indispensable to as many people as possible. Make so many people financially dependent on you, do so much stocker, so much charity, give so much, help so many people, that when you are Mr. A walking down the street, and Mr. B
turns the corner, Hashem will look down on you and say, you know what? He'll say, it's just too darn complicated to take you out of the picture. I'm going to have you around a little longer because so many people need you. It's not the highest motivation for Stocker, but it is a kosher approach. So the first point is that you are protected against human aggression. We are not saying that free will to affect someone else illegitimately is given in a carte blanche fashion that you can do whatever you want. What we are saying is that you can use your free will against someone only to the tune that they are not protected by source. There are many other modifiers as well. One of them is that the victim is protected by his merit against the aggressor. There are many other exceptions to the second opinion. Stay with me, this is not simple. Let's call it the second opinion, right? Not Rav Sajja's opinion. The opinion of Lora Chaim and those who follow him, or those who take that line. You can affect someone else through your free will in an undeserving fashion, but only subject to many variables. One, are they protected by inafskus or not? Two, wartime, war has a different dispensation entirely. Milchamos ani asisi, Hashem says. War has a different, no time now to go into the exact differences, but war sets up a different tension in this area and that raises other issues. Three, a mass disaster is handled differently, providentially, than an individual attack. When a mass of people are threatened, a group of people, particularly a mass of people, when a large, the Gemara puts it like this, Kevin Shinitin Rashus Lamashkes Lashkes, when the destroyer is given permission to destroy, Shuv Enoi Mavchin Bein Sadik LeRosha, he no longer distinguishes between those who deserve and those who don't. When Lo Yaleinu, a Holocaust situation diverts, or a massive attack or disaster situation that threatens the Jewish people, then what happens is a different Hashkocha takes over, where the merit of individuals is no longer valid and the mass is dealt with as a mass. That itself is a very difficult issue and of course needs full discussion, but that is another exception where the individual is not the free will of one individual against another is not as relevant as we have been discussing. A fourth example would be where a group is involved, not necessarily a major group. For example, Elchanan Wasserman has a fascinating discussion of what happens when, for example, let's say a ship is sinking. The Gemara says that there are two possibilities. Why are the people on board that ship now about to sink? There are two possibilities, two distinct possibilities. One is that all of those people have met their moment of death, meaning that everybody who needed to die at that moment was invited to take a trip on the same ship. That's what's going on behind the scenes. The Talmudic language is Mazminam Lepundak Echad. Hashem has invited them all to the same locale in which they will all meet their deaths. But there's another possibility, that someone on that ship needs to die and the others just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's called Oile Rosh Oile Shechena. Right? You are not, this is not your destiny, but you have been caught up in the destiny of someone else. We learned this in last week's Pasha. If you in Korach, this is the source for this. How that works, again, each of these elements obviously major discussion, but that is called Oile. There's a massive practical difference, of course. If it's the first case scenario, trying to escape will not help you. You've been invited on that ship for a reason. But if it's the second case scenario, get the heck out of there. You are only in trouble now because of somebody else's destiny that you have become attached to, and escape may in fact be a possibility. So those are exceptions, and there are a number of other reasons or factors where free will does not exist. I'll just mention one more. The free will of an individual to affect many is severely curtailed when he has a lot of political power. A person of major political power has no free will at all with respect to the masses. This is called Lev Sarim, Lev Melachim Vesarim B'Yad Hashem. That the heart of kings and princes is in Hashem's hand. Hashem said that when a person becomes a king, or a prince, or a president, or a prime minister, somebody who has major political power, all his free will is taken away with respect to his jurisdiction. He becomes a puppet in the hand of Hashem. The irony, of course, in Western society is that when a person becomes elected president, that's when he thinks he has real power. In Torah, at that moment he becomes a completely transparent puppet who is used only for the destiny of the masses. He has no free will with respect to them. That's another exception. And there are many other variables that limit the second opinion. So in summary, what we said today
is that there are two ways to approach the problem of one person's free will affecting your life. One opinion is, you never touch anyone else. All you do is choose to act, and act, and for that you're responsible. But what happens to them has nothing to do with you. The second opinion is, you can act under certain limited circumstances. One of them happens to be that you need to be a major individual. You need to be a Baal Bechira. It's no accident that Or HaChaim teaches us this by the great brothers of Joseph, people of cosmic greatness. You want to affect somebody else's destiny, you have to be somebody big. You have to have real free will. This does not apply to a 14-year-old Arab that they strap a bomb to his back and send him into a crowded bus in Jerusalem. It's got nothing to do with today's sugya. Nothing at all. This has to be an individual of massive capacity who has developed the ability, for good or for bad, to manifest his free will to change another's destiny when he targets an individual. That is the second opinion. There's one more layer to this discussion if you have the energy and the time.
You're a free man.
There's one more layer which is a little difficult to perhaps to express, but let me try, and I hope you'll find it rewarding. In a famous work, the Chinuch, right, which as you know I'm sure deals with mitzvahs, the Chinuch touches on this point in two places and appears to contradict himself. I'd like to share with you that contradiction and suggest to you a possible resolution. Okay, are you game? This takes a little concentration. Yes, you willing?
Yeah.
There are two places where he implies an attitude to this question, and it seems like he takes the opposite view in both places, which is certainly not possible. You're talking about a major Torah authority who could never contradict himself on a fundamental like this. But let me share with you what appears to be the contradiction and see if we can resolve it. The first place he talks about this is when he deals with the mitzvah of revenge and bearing a grudge. Netira and Nekama, right? If you want to look it up, it is in Resh Mem and Resh Mem Aleph in the Sefer HaChinuch. He talks about the problem of bearing a grudge and taking revenge. In Judaism, there is a prohibition to hold a grudge against someone, and there's a prohibition of taking revenge, right? What is the technical definition? Taking revenge means your neighbor, you go over to your neighbor one day, you say, "Can I please borrow your lawnmower?" And your neighbor says, "No." Next week he comes over to you and says, "Can I please borrow your lawnmower?" And you say, "No." That's called nekama. You're doing to him what he did to you. That is forbidden in Judaism. Bearing a grudge is when you go to your neighbor and say, "Can I please borrow your lawnmower?" And he says, "No." Next week he comes over to you and says, "Can I please borrow yours?" And you say, "Sure, I'm not like you." That's called netira. You are not taking revenge, but you are bearing the grudge and reminding him what he did. You are forbidden to do that, right? They tell a story about a man crawling through the desert, dying of thirst. And as he was about to die, another fellow rode past on a horse, looked down at him, ignored him and left him to die, and rode on. Miraculously, the fellow survived. And a few years later, found himself the president of a major business corporation, when one day his office door opened and a man came in begging for a job. And he recognized the face or the man who had left him to die in the desert. Had he refused to give him the job, he would be guilty of nekama, revenge. Had he given him the job but reminded him of the incident, he would be guilty of netira. He said nothing and gave the man the job. That is what you're required to do as a Jew. Of course, if the man is unsuitable for the work, let's say the position that he's applying for is to be the gentle, tender caregiver of little old ladies, then you might legitimately exclude him on the grounds, not of revenge, but of the fact that he's unsuitable for the work. That's different, that's fine. If your neighbor destroys lawnmowers, then you don't have to lend him your lawnmower. But that is the prohibition. Now, listen carefully. Says the Chinuch, why should you not bear a grudge? You know, the Chinuch is famous not only for discussing the halachic parameters of mitzvahs, but also for giving you what he calls mishol shea mitzvah. What is Hashem's thinking, as it were? What's the reason, so to speak, for this mitzvah? And he says like this. When someone harms you, listen well. Do you know why you should not bear a grudge against him or harm him? Here I am, and this person has harmed me very badly. Very, very badly. And I have a tremendous urge to take revenge against him. It's one of the most powerful urges. And the sensation of taking revenge is one of the sweetest human emotions. Right? And therefore, I have a very powerful urge to avenge myself on this individual. Says the Chinuch, that's stop. You know why you should not take revenge against him? Because whatever happens to you, you deserve. It's got nothing to do with him.
Had it not been him, you would have gotten it another way. Which opinion is this?
What we call the first opinion. Very clearly. Very clearly seems to be the first. What do you got against him?
When a person hits a dog with a stick, and the dog turns around and bites the stick, he's mistaken, the dog. He doesn't know that the hand wields the stick. When this individual harms me, and I wish to take revenge against him, I misunderstand my own Ashkocha. He is only Hashem's agent. That's what he seems to be saying. Look it up, because the words are very, very instructive. But that appears to be his opinion. And in one other place, he appears to contradict himself. This will take a moment to explain. When he deals with the mitzvah of Edim Zomerim, right, and I'll finish with this. Edim Zomerim, which he deals with in Taf Kuf Chaf Damit. What's that? Taf Kuf 524. He deals with the mitzvah of Edim Zomerim. Here's what he says. Imagine you have two witnesses. Two witnesses who testify against two other witnesses, right? Here's a person on trial, let's say in a life capital matter, and we have conflicting evidence. You have two witnesses saying that he's guilty of murder, and two witnesses who say that he's not guilty. That's two against two, the case is closed, we have conflicting evidence, and by the way, in Jewish law, all four witnesses remain valid. Since we don't know which two are lying, if a new case occurs tomorrow and these two pitch up, we'll listen to the evidence. If another case occurs the next day and these two pitch up, we'll take the evidence too. There's only two whom we will never believe. Who are they?
No.
If these two...
No.
Let's say these two accuse a person of murder. These two exonerate him. We know the two are lying. Right. We will accept their evidence in the future because we'll assume they're telling the truth. We'll accept their evidence in the future because we'll assume they're telling the truth. What we'll never accept is one of these and one of those together. Because then for sure we have a lie here. Okay. But in Adam Zomerim you have another peculiarity, and it's like this. Imagine these two witnesses say that this person committed a murder. And these two witnesses do not contradict the evidence, but they say you could not have been there at the time. The moment you say you witnessed the murder, right, this person killing, we saw you at some other place at that time. That's not called conflicting evidence, that's called hazama. Hazama means they impugn the veracity or the reliability or the truthfulness of the witnesses. They say you could not have witnessed the event. That's called hazama. And the Torah has a very, what appears to be a peculiar judgment. The Torah's judgment, which is not reflected in secular law, as far as I'm aware, is that we believe the second two witnesses. These two say they saw the murder. These two say the murder could have taken place. We don't know about that. But you could not have been present. We believe the second two. And we do to the first two what they tried to do to the victim. If they try to get the victim killed, they get killed. If they want to obligate money, they have to pay money. Now there are two peculiarities here. One of them I'm not going to deal with today. I'll leave that to you for homework. And that is, why believe the second two and not the first? After all, who says that these two are trying to frame him? Maybe these two are trying to frame them. That's a fascinating question, and it's amenable to logical analysis. See if you can figure that out. Why do we believe the second two? But there's a more peculiar question, and it's this, and the Chinuch deals with it. The Maharal has a famous resolution of this. Many others talk about it. And here it is. Listen carefully. When the second two witnesses say that the first two are lying, we do to the victim... We do to them what they try to do to the victim only if the sentence had not yet been executed. If the sentence has already been executed, they're free. Is that weird? Let's get it 100% clear. This person's on trial for his life, right? These two say that he committed a murder. These two say that those two are lying. So if the person has not yet been executed, he's being marched out to the place of execution, and he's about to be killed, and at the last minute these two rush in and they say, wait, they're lying. We stop the execution, we call him back, we listen to the testimony, and it turns out that these two are lying. What do? We free the accused and kill the two false witnesses. Clear? Scenario number two. These two testify that the person killed, he's marched out to the place of execution and killed dead. 5 minutes later, these two rush in and they say, wait! What happens? They teach us that these two are lying, no problem, scot-free. Is that weird?
Morris.
If
If they try to kill a person and they fail, they get killed. If they try to kill somebody and they succeed, they're free. The Gemara answers, that's what the Torah says. So the Maharal deals with this and many others. Listen to what the Chinuch says. He says, I will give you a partial reason. He calls it a ksas time. Why is the person, why are the witnesses executed only if the person was not executed? But if he was, they're free. Listen carefully. I hope you'll enjoy this. And if it doesn't move you, there's no hope for you. This is what he says. When these two witnesses come in and say, yeah, they say the person is lying. If the person has been killed already, you know why we do nothing to the witnesses who are lying? Because if he got killed, he must have had it coming. If he died, then it must be right. There's no way that witnesses could testify and get a person killed if he didn't deserve it. And therefore, there's no need to kill the witnesses because they never did anything to him. He was going to die anyway. Now, think carefully. Which of the two opinions does this appear to support? The first one again. And here's the complication. He then adds one sentence which completely reverses the whole concept. And here's the sentence. He said, listen carefully, it's very beautiful to understand. He says, the reason that if the person was killed, there's nothing we do to the witnesses, is because if he got killed at the hands of a Beis Din, it must have been correct. You know why? Because when a Beis Din sits in judgment, Elohim Nitzav Ba'adas Hadayonim, Hashem sits together with judges. When Hashem sits together with a convocation of judges in a Beis Din, you can be sure that the consequence will always be right, because Hashem is part of that Beis Din. Some of Foshim say this is the only reason that we can sit in judgment on other people, because Hashem assures us that if we do the right move halachically, He will be there with us. And therefore, if the Beis Din judged this person to death and he got killed, you can rest assured that the sentence, by the way, it doesn't mean he committed this murder, but it means that he needed to die, and therefore there's no problem. Elokim Nitza Ba'adas Kael, Hashem sits together with the judges, and therefore you can rely on the consequence being true. Now we make what's called a diuk. Diuk means an inference, and here's the inference. If Hashem sits together with a Beis Din and a consequence occurs which is the death of an individual, it must be correct. Here's the diuk. But if it's not a Beis Din, it's just you or me acting unilaterally, the result might not be correct. That's a very simple diuk. Again, he's very fussy to say that the only place you can rely on a person's destiny being accurate is only because a Beis Din has ruled. When a Beis Din rules, there's a guarantee that the consequence is true because Hashem is there. Very clearly implying that if it's not a Beis Din, it's just me alone, Mr. A walking down the street, where Hashem is not together with him in that decision, it could go wrong. This sounds like the second opinion. Let me finish with a resolution, which I heard from Rav Moshe Shapira, and I think is very elegant, and look up the words yourself and satisfy yourself. He says this, the Chinuch certainly holds like the Orach Chaim. Right? A Beis Din is an exception. But in normal circumstances, with all the givens that are required, you could impinge your free will on somebody else unjustly. What does he mean in the comma? He means this. Listen well. I wish to take revenge on this individual, right? Because he hurt me. I want to take revenge. Hashem says, don't do that. You know why? Don't look to his free will as the agent of my harm. Look to your own lack of skus. Had I had enough merit, I would have been protected against his free agency. In other words, he has free will, and he harmed me, and it would not have happened otherwise, and he is accountable. But if you're spiritually mature, you don't look to him. You look to the fact that had you been more meritorious spiritually, you would have been protected. Look at his words and see if you think that it supports that notion. But if you learn this way, then the Chinuch holds like the Orach Chaim. Let's come back to the case we began with, and I'll stop there. I think it's a bit. I'm happy to stay for questions, but I don't know if you have time, so perhaps we'll stop here. Let's come back to the original case. Three judges on the Beis Din, two of them lying, one of them wondering what he should do. Says the Pesach Shiva, who asked me the Pesach Shiva reference. He says this: when the Sanhedrin is sitting and they're about to vote on a man's life, the reason that the final member of the Sanhedrin should say the truth is because this is a Sanhedrin and Hashem is sitting together with us. You have no worries. If you believe that the man's guilty, say guilty. The fact that he walks free is exactly correct. Why? Because the Torah predicates this. this process. The Torah says do this. The Torah says say the truth. Judge what he sees. And Hashem is sitting together with us. Therefore the man is freed quite correctly. But when you're sitting on a Beis Din with two lying judges, this ain't no Beis Din. Hashem not sitting together with two liars and you. Hashem sitting together with a duly constituted Sanhedrin or Beis Din. Then the consequence will be true. So he says, and he rules like this: if you find yourself on a Beis Din that is valid, and you hold that the other two are wrong, say the truth. You get outvoted, that's fine. But if you hold the other two are not wrong, but they are lying, get out of there. Don't vote for the truth. Say, I don't know. Get out of there, because there are no assurances about this scenario. Okay, that is a brief look at the question of the two approaches to the Chida and...